I know it's so easy to want a little time to relax after being in the exhibit hall doing lunch and networking with people, to pull yourself away to hear platform presentations. So I'm glad to see you here. I am not Pam Mitchell, but I'm Katya Hill. Pam had some family issues to deal with. So since I was already in this session, Ray Grott asked me, Katya, you can't refuse. So I'm going to be moderating today. My paper, along with Autumn's and Caitlin's, is the first paper. We have 15 minutes to present. We'll present our papers in 10 minutes and leaving 5 minutes for question and answer or discussion around our topic. And not to change what I've been known for, again, this is a controversial area, so my paper's on consumer protection policies in an evidence-based practice, client-centered milieu. Basically, what this paper presents is some survey data on current business structures and codes of conducts of AAC manufacturers, and it duplicates the results or compares the results of a survey that we conducted 10 years ago to see what the status is of the marketplace now in terms of where it might have been 10 years ago. So as I give you some background information, we're well aware of trying to be delivering services in terms of a more client-centered approach and having our clients and family members become more responsible for the decision-making, as well as empowering them in being fully informed of the decisions that are made in the matching persons with technology process. So the next couple of points, I'm not going to go into a lot of detail because this is a 10-minute presentation, but I want to provide you with just some little bullets of points to think about of what this means as professionals in terms of the policies that we might feel we need to develop or put in place to protect consumers. For those of us that have been in AAC for maybe 15, 20, 30 years, if not more, we're well aware that the industry has changed from a mom and pop companies to now being a well-established profit-driven and reimbursement-controlled marketplace. Okay. But we also know that there's an expectation for professionals to be critically evaluating evidence on the effectiveness of AAC interventions before recommending or accepting products. Now, we also have a situation that we're well aware of, is that AAC manufacturers tend to be a source for a lot of the evidence that we're using to guide our decisions. So here was the problem that we looked at 10 years ago, as well as then wanting to re-look at and see where we stood, is that the ownership structures of a business influence their sales models, and those sales models then in turn influence their business practices. So many businesses outside of, let's say, the assistive technology industry have their companies write codes of conduct in an attempt to improve public confidence in their sales practices and the marketing evidence that they're using. Okay. So can we identify, then, what are the stated business structures of our AAC manufacturers today, and how those business structures may influence their business objectives? And then can we identify the existence of codes of conduct that may have been instituted by various AAC manufacturers? So what we did is to replicate the procedures from a Hill, Linton, and Glennon 1998 survey that was presented at ISAC in Dublin, where we identified the business structures of AAC manufacturers, as well as identified the codes of conduct that the manufacturers may have on their books. Okay. Presently, we were able to identify 12 AAC manufacturers from the ATIA website. And we then did an internet search following procedures that we thought would be typical of the clinician in the trenches, as well as a consumer or family, of how they might track down this information. So we did internet searches on the manufacturers' websites, and then if we couldn't find the information to answer these questions about their business structure and if they had a code of conduct, we called up the manufacturer, generally got referred to the human resource department, and then asked them if they had a code of conduct and if they could supply us with a copy of that code of conduct. Okay. So here are our targeted two questions from those phone calls. Now, here are the business structures that were a result of conducting this survey in January of 2008. So on the internet searches, we found that none of the manufacturers had their ownership or business structure clearly identified as information at the website. However, if you search through their websites and look at various press releases on the website, you can then track down or identify what might be their ownership structures for four of the companies, or 33%. Okay. In then making phone calls, we were able to identify more. So we found that of those 12 companies, two companies had sole proprietor or were privately owned. One company is part of a publicly traded corporation. Eight were identified as corporations. However, three are employee-owned. Two were supported by venture capital, and two were unknown. And then for one of those companies, we were unable to get any information. Now, I'm not going to comment as to what that business structure means if you are a corporation, if you're privately owned, if you're employee owned, or if you're supported by venture capitalists. That is up to you to understand how those business structures may influence your sales practices or how your business organization. So then we looked at whether or not the companies could produce for us or share with us a code of conduct. 8% or 1 out of 12 of the AAC manufacturers had a code of conduct at their website or available through the human resource person. Now, this was compared to 20% of the companies in 1998. And I know at that time the authors of the original paper had discussed with Isaac, having Isaac look at an initiative to promote manufacturers to writing their own codes of conduct and sharing that with the AAC community. So we can see not only did that not happen, we have a decline of companies even having available codes of conduct. Okay. One of the things that we found interesting that in talking to the human resource personnel, they referred us to the HIPAA guidelines or the supplier standards for Medicare that were used by their sales force in place of a code of conduct. And if you look at businesses that have written codes of conduct or have had consultants come in and help their employees write codes of conduct, is that the HIPAA guidelines and standards do not meet the definition of a code of conduct. Okay. So what I think is up to discussion is that we know that there are new ownership structures happening in the AAC industry that puts management in a position to meet investor expectations rather than holding the interests of the consumers or the practitioner in mind. So your investor is your primary person that the business is having to satisfy, not necessarily who your main customers are. And that's a very different approach that as clinical service providers, we need to be aware of how that may be influencing the relationship we have with a vendor. In addition, we can see that some of the shift has been toward a pharmaceutical sales model. If the industry is moving from client-centered care to industry profitability, what type of consumer protection guidelines might we be discussing to help protect our decision-making? Okay. Now, I'm not saying that this is a recommendation, but one of the things is that there is no specialty certification in conducting AAC evaluations. And I'm not saying that we need to go there, but on our next points, if we look at the fact that consumers are not protected from an AAC manufacturer's sales force that does not hold clinical certificates or licenses, and the industry is not putting in place professional codes of ethics or a code of conduct, then we have to be very savvy as to what our relationships are. And is there a minimum safeguard should be utilized to build awareness of AAC supplier practices that constitute unfair pressure and play upon the lack of and knowledge and experience of the consumer? So we know we have consumers that are doing internet searches, are finding technology, coming to professionals and saying, this is what I want, or going to exhibit halls and looking at systems and saying, this is what I want, and then trying to use that as their guiding decision making. Well, if that relationship is solely between a vendor manufacturer that does not have a code of conduct to hold up in terms of referring to a professional that will do an independent evaluation, you can see that it can be problematic in terms of consumer protection issues. Okay. So I guess as professional organizations may want to be looking at what kind of consumer protection policies we may want to be developing, because from our survey data, we're not seeing that AAC manufacturers or vendors are necessarily doing this on their own or independently or wanting to or initiating working with professional organizations to develop consumer protection guidelines. Okay. And I'm open for questions. Yes. I did not look for other AT manufacturers. I'm presenting this information from what we have historically seen now in the AAC industry. And we do have ownership shifts occurring with venture capitalists coming into AAC. And we can say, knowing what some of the wheelchair manufacturers are, similar shifts occurring. As the industry grows bigger, venture capital is more attractive to an industry with larger sales. Okay. So what we do know is that you invest in a company in order to get a stronger interest in the money that you're investing, more so than if you invested it in other traditional avenues like stocks or bank certificates, et cetera. Okay. Yes, David.
Is there going to change in that with the pandemic?
We didn't like track that consistently, so it would be anecdotal in nature and based on impressions. I could say, like, my impression would be, as we have seen how larger corporations have purchased AAC companies and then severed or let that go because their expectation may not have been met by improving their business. The other trend kind of that we have seen, I would say, is that larger companies purchasing smaller AAC companies and then incorporating them in. I would say, as a practitioner myself, is that I think a healthy AAC marketplace is when we have a lot of companies competing and small companies feel that they have a more equal playing field to start up and to be recognized. And I'm not sure if we're seeing that, those types of mom and pop innovations. That was one of the exciting things 30 years ago of going to exhibit hall and seeing some things that really didn't work, but you saw creative people out there giving it their best shot. Yes, right. And so it's a very different industry now. So just by looking at the marketing literature that we're getting. Okay. So I think that people have to be very aware of the difference now in evidence-based practice, that there is the external research evidence and then there is marketing evidence. And a lot of consumers as well as clinicians that have been out there cannot necessarily distinguish what's marketing evidence to what is doing a critical review or evaluating the actual research base. Yes. Well, not necessarily. We are seeing with AMA becoming much stricter with the pharmaceutical industry and their practices with physicians in terms of dropping off samples or other types of products or taking them to those nice big vacations or parties. We've seen an increase in the industry of people being taken places and parties and dropping off things, cold calling, as well as pharmaceutical salespeople that have been laid off because of the restrictions in AMA now being hired in our industry. Okay, so I think anybody that is dealing with a sales rep should ask them what their background is. So I know that I do. And I've been burnt by that before of various reps coming in, implying that they have a clinical practice, implying a background, and then later finding out that they had no clinical background whatsoever. Okay, they didn't outright lie, but the implication of how they were talking to me was such that I was talking them to them as if they were another SLP, and they weren't. Am I out of time? I would think so. So thank you very much. I think this is an important topic. So anybody that wants to see if we can do anything or what we might need to do, I'd appreciate it. Barry?
Okay, we do not have a handout for you. I guess you have them available on the CD. Of the various ways that communication performance can be quantified, the communication rate of individuals who use AAC is the parameter of greatest performance deficiency relative to that of naturally speaking individuals. So this is a pretty important thing. Generally, when we talk to people that use AAC, communication rate is the second most important thing to them when they're looking at systems. There are certainly other ways that communication can be quantified, but if we look at MLU in words, morphology use, core vocabulary use, sentence structure, communication rate is 15% plus or minus. It's possible for a person using AAC to have equal performance to speaking people in those other areas. So communication rate's pretty important. Optimizing communication rate's important to people who use AAC. So what are some of the factors that influence AAC communication rate? Obviously, directly, it's selection rate. How fast a person can put information into an AAC system is going to determine how fast the information comes back out in terms of words per minute. So there is a selection technique or a method of some kind. There's expertise that's developed in the use of that, and that's training and practice, and perhaps other factors influence that. Language representation methods have different kinds of performance inside the system. And so those are the basic methods, and we'll come back to those in a moment. So from a systems perspective, we can look at an AAC system as a box where we're putting information in and we're getting communication out. If we look at units of measure, bits, a bit is the lowest bit of piece of information. We're putting bits into a system, we're getting words out. When we add a time factor to it, which is basically what we're talking about here in communication rate, words per minute is the standard way in which we're measuring that. Bits per second is the normal way in which information rate is measured, and that's taken directly from the human factors field. So information rate is basically the selection rate, how fast a person can make choices in putting information into a system, pushing keys on a keyboard or whatever is going to be the appropriate way for the individual. Communication rate, of course, is the words per minute that's coming out of the system. And the rate index was a factor that was introduced several years ago now as a way of relating those two. And the rate index is basically the communication rate over the selection rate divided by 60. So the unit of measure for that is words per bit. And that's basically what's going on inside the AAC system, is that you put in so many bits, you should expect to get so many words out. So you put in a rate, you get out a rate. So bits per second going in, words per minute coming out. So basically we have a rate index there in the device, in the system, device plus the application program. So if we know the selection rate and the rate index, we can calculate what the communication rate is. And it's just a simple formula, selection rate times the rate index times 60. So again, selection rate, bits per second, rate index, words per bit, 60 seconds per minute. So we end up with communication rate in words per minute. Many AAC systems have multiple language representation methods. And the language representation method use that's being chosen by the individual is generally divided among the available methods. So for example, some people are going to use spelling part of the time, some are going to use word prediction part of the time, single meaning pictures. So it's going to be a function of the individual use, and typically of the performance that's achieved. So if we go back to the system and we add these elements of the different language representation methods, what we find is that different language representation methods can have different selection rates. How fast a person is pushing keys is going to be a function of the method being used. And they have different rate indices. So if we go back to the model, what's going in gets divided among these different methods. Each method produces words, and the words come out. So how do we accommodate the different methods that are used inside the system? In terms of that communication rate formula, we basically take the selection rate times the rate index times the percentage that is used for that particular method, and we do that for each of the language representation methods. So we sum those together, and we should end up with a reasonable prediction of the communication rate for the system. Performance Report Tool is software that has been available for some time in lower versions. We're just finishing version 3 now that actually divides out to give the selection rate and the rate index as a function of the method of language representation. So we end up with, in this case, the example didn't have any word predictions, single meaning picture or orthographic word selection use, but we end up seeing that the selection rate for semantic compaction and spelling have that kind of ratio. The rate indices for those two, we end up with what the numbers are. So what we wanted to do is to take this notion and test it. And so we had a test subject using 128, Unity 128 on a Pathfinder, manual keyboard direct selection, self-identified as an effective communicator, and we conducted an interview language sample collection procedure. We looked at the selection rate and the rate index and the relative use of the different methods for single meaning pictures, spelling, word prediction, and semantic compaction. And then what we did is to take five subjects of similar profile, again, direct selectors, all Unity 128 on Pathfinders. We looked at the spelling selection rate, which is what we had available at that time, prior to the new version of PERT, and then we calculated the communication rate that each of them was able to achieve through separate language samples. And so what we found is that the predicted communication rate was roughly 110% of what the average actual communication rate was. And the range on that was 87% to 127%. So it gives us a little bit of an idea of, at least within the constraints of what we were working with there, that we have a reasonable ability to predict communication rate for people of similar profile. So the clinical applications for this, we would suggest that in the system recommendation assessment process, this will help us come to better decisions. Funding request enhancement. If the better information that we have to provide to funding sources, the more likely we're going to get what we're asking for. And that's certainly been the case for other language sample contributions to that process. Therapy goal setting to give us better tools to be able to decide what are things that we need to be working on and what are things that are going well as are. Progress monitoring. I'd be able to see what's happening with using the systems in different ways as we have more information. Case study sharing and clinical research. So this is the basic idea. If we can predict communication rate, we can make better choices and achieve better outcomes. That's it. How am I doing on time? Okay. Okay, I'm done. I'm happy for questions. Mm-hmm. Hello? That was fast, yes. Okay. Yes. Right here. The average predicted communication rate, so we had five predicted communication rates, and we averaged those together. That ended up being 110% of the actual average of the actual communication rates for those five individuals. So we had five predictions and five actuals. We averaged both sets, and we found that there was a 10% difference on the average. The predicted was 10% greater than the actual. Yes. But that's an average, and as you can see, the range was 87 to 127%. What we were predicting was communication rate. Five individual participants. We were using the formula that I just presented in terms of looking at the amount of use of the different language representation methods and the actual selection rate that they had achieved. And that was measured. Mm-hmm. Yes? these were all self-identified as being effective communicators. And I think overall our performance measurement confirmed that. Yes. So it's what's really important here is that the profiles need to be a reasonably good match. Yes. Yes. A good point, and the people with whom we were working are relatively homogeneous, that there's not a lot of variability from one to another in terms of their language capability. We have not done that yet, and that would be clearly one of the next things we'd want to do is to see how tightly we can make the profile so that there's a useful prediction. Yeah. Time? Okay. You know where I am.
Well, thank you for coming today. I'd like to talk a little bit about a project we did a year or two back looking at telework for individuals who use augmentative and alternative communication. And now you're going to see how much I know about PowerPoint. Let's see, here we go. Good, so thank you. The title for this presentation is actually taken from a quote from one of the participants in our study who was involved in telework, and she said, you know, the way she thinks of it is work is at home and home is at work. So what I'd like to talk about is the results of our study looking at the benefits and challenges of telework for individuals who use augmentative and alternative communication. For those of you who are involved with transition age youth who use augmentative and alternative communication and are looking at employment issues, I'm sure you're familiar with many of the traditional challenges to employment for individuals that use AAC. So transportation's often a major issue. When we spoke to some individuals who use AAC and were employed full-time in the workplace, sometimes they talked about having 12, 14-hour days. That by the time they added up waiting for Wheel-Trans to get them to work, the actual work and Wheel-Trans to get them home, they were looking at an enormous physical challenge. So clearly transportation is often a challenge for traditional workplace environments. Technology access, so having access to all the specialized technology that's needed, and personal care services. Again, when we spoke to individuals who use AAC and were involved in traditional workplaces, sometimes they spoke about family members needing to be the ones that would come in and provide assistance with toileting and assistance with feeding. So clearly we've got a lot of problems with traditional workplace environments for individuals that use AAC. I'm not saying that we shouldn't keep fighting those challenges and continuing to try and change what's going on there, but we are starting to see people look at alternatives to traditional workplace environments, and one of those alternatives is telework. And telework is the idea that an individual is involved in work activities that take place outside the normal work setting and are made possible by internet and telecommunications technologies. So these are individuals that are working at home and communicating with the workplace via email, via the telephone, those sorts of distance communication technologies. In our study, we identified 9 individuals who used augmentative and alternative communication. They worked at least 10 hours per week in paid telework activities and had been employed for at least 3 months. 8 of these individuals had a diagnosis of cerebral palsy. 1 of these individuals had a diagnosis of autism. Variety of employment activities. 2 of these individuals were involved in advocacy work. 2 of these individuals were involved in technical support, so individuals that had difficulties with assistive technology would contact the manufacturer and be relayed to these individuals who provided technical support. 2 were involved in database management. 2 were involved in teaching. 1 of these individuals was actually a college professor who used augmentative and alternative communication and taught an online course as her way of interacting with her students. And finally, 1 of these individuals was involved in technical writing. For 7 of these individuals, their telework activities were their main source of income. For 2 of these individuals, it was used to supplement Social Security. When we spoke to these individuals about the benefits of telework, a number of things showed up. Efficiency of working at home. So again, if you can cut out 4 hours of transportation a day, you can get a lot more done with your life. The flexibility of scheduling. A lot of these individuals appreciated the fact that they could work in medical appointments, work in therapy appointments, without having to disrupt the workday. So it was a lot easier to work from home and coordinate all the other things going on in their life. Clearly, like all of us, financial benefits is what sort of drives working at the end of the day. And relationships with coworkers. So some of these individuals, all of these individuals spoke positively about their relationship with coworkers to some extent. Some individuals who had been involved in traditional workplace actually felt they had stronger personal relationships because of the telework environment. They felt that being able to communicate via email placed them on a more equal communication footing than trying to have sort of the traditional water cooler conversation in a traditional workplace. So some of these individuals felt they had stronger relationships with their coworkers because they were in a telework environment. As I'll mention in a few moments, some individuals sort of wondered whether they'd have better relationships if they were in a traditional workplace environment, but I'll be with that in just a minute. So again, some more details around the efficiency of working at home. My trip to the office is cut from an hour and a half to 30 seconds. This is the university faculty member. I can present my knowledge to my students more precisely. It's better than teaching them face-to-face. So for that particular individual, she really felt she could communicate more effectively over the internet than she could in a face-to-face conversation. Challenges, and I've rightly or wrongly, for the purposes of this presentation, I'm going to talk more about the challenges and the benefits, but I hope I don't leave you with the impression that the people were essentially negative. The people were extremely positive. I just felt the challenge for this group should be to hear more about the challenges so we can start to think about how to address them. So some of the challenges that came up were communication with coworkers. So one of the individuals said that communication by phone or email loses the face-to-face interaction that many people need to establish trust. And I think there's an element of that that's hard to get away from. Some of the individuals felt that because they were always working at home and didn't have that face-to-face interaction with their peers, they sort of wondered whether they were always thought of when new projects were being planned, or whether they were always thought of when there were new initiatives being considered. I think one of the changes that's gone on in the workplace recently is it's not like you sort of get a job and then you plug away at that job for 30 years and then you retire with the gold watch. We're much more in a work environment where what people do changes every 2 to 3 years. And I think it's a legitimate question to ask if you're not physically present in the workplace, or if you don't have some way of really making people know who you are people likely to think of you when they're thinking of starting up new projects and starting new initiatives? So, again, I'm not sure we've totally figured out how we make sure that people that are involved in telework activities are still sort of in some way present or is still some way recognized in the workplace. Motivation. It's much harder to stay focused at home than it is at work. And speaking as somebody that's still trying to find the best way of managing my work style, I think that's true. There's so many temptations at home. There's thinking about all the other things you need to look after. Some of the individuals wondered whether they'd actually get more focused work done if they were in a traditional setting rather than exposed to all the temptations of home. Another individual commented, my working space and living space totally overlap and constantly interfere with each other. So what this individual also commented on was she never really felt like she got a break. So even at the end of the day when it was sort of like 5 o'clock and you're supposed to stop work, because there wasn't that physical movement from the workplace to the home environment, she always sort of had this nagging feeling that she wasn't on top of everything she should be on top of. So again, how you manage separating your work life from your home life. Reduce social interaction. I can't say to my workers, let's go for a beer, they're 150 miles away. So again, that concern about the lack of informal social interactions. Out of these challenges came some recommendations for employers. First, that employers really think about ways that they can promote interaction with teleworkers. So to think more than they typically would about arranging conference calls, things where they could really draw in the teleworker and make them more a part of the workplace. To be flexible and consider the need for accommodations, and to really think about providing a positive, inclusive environment. And what was especially important here was the expectation that the employer would really set the tone for how people should think of that teleworker. Coworkers really pick up on how the boss thinks about other employees, and it was really important that the boss really set the tone. Recommendations for manufacturers, independent internet access. So for all of these individuals, it was really important that we try and think of ways that it's easier for them to hook up to the internet. Better ways to operate the mouse. The actual quote from this discussion group was, whoever invented the mouse should be shot, which seems a little extreme, but there's a lot of frustration out there. Natural sounding voices, better technical support and training, and of course, lower costs. Thank you. I had no idea how long this would take, so I know I did that at quite a pace, but I thought I'd get through my content and then leave some time for questions. So, welcome. Lyle.
Good afternoon. I'm going to be talking about augmenting aphasia therapy with language-based software and speech-generating device-assisted approaches. Providing speech-language therapy to individuals with aphasia often requires addressing a number of language deficits. And these would include inability to understand speech, difficulty with formulation of speech, word retrieval difficulty, deficits in both oral reading and comprehension of material read, inability to spell correctly, and difficulty with writing or typing due to a combination of the above deficits. Traditional therapy for aphasia often uses one of three approaches. In the stimulus-based approach, the clinician provides information seeking a target response from the patient. In a functional communication approach, the patient attempts to convey novel information through a variety of trained modalities. Use of workbook therapy assignments also serve to provide in-session or take-home activities for additional practice. This paper suggests the provision of two additional therapy approaches for augmenting traditional aphasia therapy. The use of language therapy software has been applied as an adjunct to therapy for a number of years. For three outpatients with aphasia, software tasks were selected that focus on naming, reading of words, sentences, or paragraphs, typing tasks for improving spelling, and associating words. Speech-generating or augmentative communication devices provide a wealth of material that also could be applied to traditional aphasia therapy. SGDs provide a large assortment of picture symbols with word labels. Speech output models give feedback for confirming selections or for repetition of words or phrases. And newer SGDs incorporate visual scenes for contextual naming and descriptions. The opportunity to use the keyboards of SGDs fosters typing and spelling skills, while word prediction can serve to assist word recognition ability. Three patients with mild to moderate aphasia were selected to receive treatment incorporating traditional, software-based, and speech-generating device-assisted therapy. DT, a 44-year-old woman, 4 years status post left CVA, had worked as a waitress and bartender prior to her stroke. She presented with a mild to moderate Broca's type aphasia. Case 2, WR, a 54-year-old man, 1 month post left CVA, worked as a teacher and presented with a moderate Broca's type aphasia. And ZL, a 59-year-old woman at 1 month post onset left brainstem CVA, who worked as a nurse and presented with a moderate anomic type aphasia. Now, all patients received outpatient therapy on a 2 to 3 times per week basis for 3 to 6 months. Each of the therapy intervention approaches was used with all of the patients. Traditional speech production therapy tasks focused on naming, describing pictures, and completing sentences, naming to description and word association. Traditional reading tasks involve reading of phrases, sentences, paragraphs, and stories, followed by yes, no, multiple choice, or open-ended questions. The Parrot software programs were used to provide additional language therapy. These included tasks of picture association, picture identification, picture categories, category naming and comprehension, and sentence comprehension. Each of the programs requires the patients to read and match words to photographs, pictures, or phrases. Patients answered 10 or to 20 items in one or two programs per session. Here's an example of a picture identification task where the patient selects one of three words to name the picture. This is another item of the picture identification task. This slide represents a newer version of the software that's available through internet subscription. One of the patients actually obtained a subscription, WR, during the course of his therapy, and had the opportunity to independently work on these tasks from his home. Here's another program where, given three words, chair, dresser, and bed, the patient must select the correct category from choices of small things, brown things, or furniture. The Lingraphic, a speech-generating device, was used to provide SGD-assisted therapy. This device is a dedicated Macintosh laptop designed to meet needs of adults with aphasia. Contains over 3,500 pre-stored words, and it uses card-shaped symbols and scenes of icons. The device uses both synthesized and digitized speech output. Here's the Lingraphica showing a picture array of vegetables. Lingraphica features a picture gallery of symbols and scenes and a workspace for sequencing icons to formulate sentences. It also provides therapy exercises. Here's a view of the picture gallery of category cards with different labels. And on this example from the therapeutic exercises section, a sentence completion task is presented. A shovel is for, and the patient selects among the words milk, books, or digging. Now, three standardized tests were administered during the course of therapy to determine patients' language and communicative abilities. The Western Aphasia Battery, in part one, assesses the content and fluency of spontaneous speech, auditory comprehension for yes or no questions, word recognition, and the ability to follow commands. It also measures repetition ability for words, phrases, and sentences. And word retrieval is assessed through naming of objects, word fluency, sentence completion, and answering responsive speech questions. The Boston Naming Test contains 60 line drawings and measures confrontational naming. It ranges from naming commonly occurring words such as tree to infrequently occurring words such as yoke. Semantic and phonemic cueing are also provided during the treatment. The CATTLE is a functional communication skill assessment measuring comprehension, expression, reading, and printing. Tasks are built around common activities. Patients can respond through speech, pointing, gesturing, or writing to convey answers to each question. Now, here's how patients perform during the course of their therapy. You can see there's encouraging improvement noted on repeat assessments with the Western Aphasia Battery. These are aphasia quotients that you're seeing. So all patients demonstrated improvement in language areas of spontaneous speech, auditory comprehension, repetition, and naming. Patients WR and ZL achieved performance within the normal range by the time of discharge. On the Boston Naming Test, all patients showed improvement scores from evaluation to discharge. There was rather limited improvement in DT scores, and the reason is we feel that's attributable to her being both 4 years post-onset, and she had some significant visual perceptual deficits. On the communicative abilities of daily living, only patient WR completed this measure at evaluation and discharge and did show encouraging improvement, while the other patients also presented good performance, exception of DT, who continued to have difficulty with some of the visual tasks on the measure. Patients reported their preferences to each of the therapy approaches, and varied opinions were provided. DT preferred the visual scenes or picture arrays for improving word retrieval, while WR preferred the language therapy software because of independent use with feedback. ZL appreciated the combination of all three approaches. Now, some additional benefits of the non-traditional approaches are language therapy software provides feedback of performance through score analysis and cueing. The patient can control the rate of task presentation and cue type. Software can be used independently, and the potential of internet subscription provides access from home to a large variety of therapy activities. Speech-generating device-assisted therapy provides visual scenes or arrays for contextual naming tasks. Word labels can be turned on and off for improving reading and sight word recognition, and spelling can be improved through copying of words and through word prediction features. So in summary, both language therapy software and speech-generating device-assisted therapy approaches were found to be effective adjuncts to traditional therapy for individuals with non-fluent aphasia. Each approach provided clinician monitoring of performance during therapy and for independent practice. And feedback through speech output, printed labels, and letter or word cues assisted patients during independent use. Thanks for the opportunity to share this information. Okay, any questions? Oh, sure, Barry.
Some AAC practitioners have reported that what happens in therapy sessions, there's little relationship to what actually happens in the actual environment. Do you have any actual environment
Well, one of the measures that the CATTLE does actually try to look more at natural environment, because the tasks themselves attempt to simulate the doctor's office visit, going to the store, interacting more in the community. So that particular measure, but we didn't actually go out into the community with the individuals. There's more of an inpatient clinic-based type setting. So. Okay. Yes?
How did these folks use the speech-generating devices?
Well,
I mean, they didn't use them to communicate.
No, it was used in addition to the therapy that was provided, the device itself was there, so they practiced naming tasks on the device, they practiced therapeutic exercises on the devices, so they had that opportunity to use it in the session. One of the patients actually was able to obtain a device to use in their home, too, during the course of the therapy. So it's different than, you know, traditional use. They were not severely impaired individuals, so they had language skills, they just had some difficulty with certain reading or word retrieval type of tasks.
And word retrieval, did they use the device?
Yes, that was very helpful for that, right, because they could name the symbols that are on the arrays, and the contextual scenes helped with that, too. All right, thank you.
I kind of see why they put me in with this, but everybody else was AAC and I'm not. So hopefully you'll just bear with me. I think some of it can apply towards particularly how it's mounted and the positions that people are using as they access their communication device. Basically, the study came about because of technology just being such an integral part of our society, and more people are using computers and on a daily basis or at least regularly. And there has been shown in regular access that extended time and awkward postures during computer use can cause discomfort or strain. So all of this is, I think as other people have mentioned, it's in the paper, it's on your CD that you got, so I'm going to go through it fairly quickly. You can see the references there. But basically, musculoskeletal discomfort was shown to be exacerbated by static joint positioning, awkward reaches, unnatural postures, also discomfort with regular mouse use, keyboard use, also visual impact of using computers, in part related to blinks and blinks per minute, as well as just eye strain from continued use of the computer. So the problem that was addressed was that alternative computer access devices have been developed for use, but we don't really have studies out that show, yes, indeed, these also can cause user discomfort, and yes, we do need to be looking at ergonomic aspects. So we selected one, which was the Tracker 1 to use for hands-free access. We wanted to identify physical discomfort, non-neutral postures, and basically we did video analysis and also took self-report on the Cornell Musculoskeletal Discomfort Questionnaire. So I figured since this was really a very constricted time frame, I'd go ahead and jump to the end and tell you what our findings were. And then if I ran out of time on the nitty-gritty, you could just go back to the paper and read it because it is on the CD. So I'm jumping to the conclusions right off. Our data did support that half or more of the participants would report neck discomfort, that more than half or half or more had no arm discomfort, that there was no lower back discomfort, and that increased discomfort was associated with sustained non-neutral cervical positions. Basically, it was a study that was conducted on a limited number of participants, and they did not have disabling conditions. But discomfort was experienced. It was similar to that found on in the literature on traditional computer access use, and hopefully it will provide that research that says, well, yes, just like any other kind of computer access, there is pain, and here's, you know, some substantiation for it. I put this little picture up here of the man on the soapbox because one of the things that I feel is very important and I try to stress is it's not just the right positioning, it's not just the right supports, but it's variety. To provide, yes, that main one purchased aspect of alternative computer access, but whatever is built in, you know, alternate with voice, or whatever other way they can access the computer. So there is relief from the different access methods. So I'll get off my soapbox. There is a further need for study, hopefully with more advanced technology than what I was able to use to measure postures and movement, as well as discomfort. And hopefully this will start us in on, you know, well, what do we need to do for guidelines in ergonomic principles for not just alternative computer access, I'll expand it here, to AAC access and use and placement on supports. So back to the details. There were more than 13 students, but there were only 13 students with complete data sets that were able to be analyzed. It was an IRB-approved study. They were seated in a wheelchair. They were not allowed to use any other body parts but their head. Using Tracker One, which I don't know if everyone's familiar with it, it's an infrared system to be able to use the computer hands-free. They were to use the Tracker One for 30 minutes, and we selected items so that they would use it, the cursor, in a variety of ways. So they did drawings on paint. And of course, as an OT, I had to have them do the house tree person, do a little psychological thing on them as well, but I didn't report that here. They had to play spider solitaire, and then they had to use an on-screen keyboard to type in a Word document. We used the Cornell. It was used that's available on the internet if anybody's interested in downloading it. It was used and calculated according to their recommendations for research purposes with a frequency score that was weighted. The video data, we basically did a profile and a frontal view with two quick cams, and then we watched it repeatedly. My students went cross-eyed, watching over and over, and we counted every blink. We counted head movements. We looked at the different positions that the head movements went. Well, it varies quite a bit. Depending on the person, but I think it's about 8 blinks. But then it depends on, well, what you're doing, if you have contacts, and if you, you know. So we also looked at sustained head postures. We looked at maximal head positions. We used video wave to select pictures. We did lines drawn vertically at the posterior of the neck, the outer canthus of the eye, top of the ear, and then the only real positions we were able to measure were cervical flexion and extension. The frontal view just was not accurate enough and did not allow us to have enough landmarks across all clients or participants, so we ended up having to use that just for collecting other data, but we weren't able to do any actual measurements on the frontal. The eye discomfort was self-report through interview. That's not part of the Cornell. The physical discomfort, there's 7 different aspects of physical discomfort that the Cornell measures, and they're listed there. We also looked at total discomfort level, which is the total score off of the Cornell, the amount of time to complete the tasks, and the number of movements of the head. And the time to complete the task varied, and this is hindsight, you know, you get, is you don't tell someone what to do, like draw a house tree person. You tell them, draw for 30 minutes or draw for however many minutes. Because if they finished quicker, then it was, well, I'm done, let's move on. So that's where we got some variety. We were not planning on having that variety in the time. So eye discomfort, their blinks ranged from 7 to 18, with a median about 16. No participants reported eye discomfort before beginning the study. 7 of them with blinks at or above the median reported eye discomfort, watery burning eyes, eye strain. 3 with blinks below the median reported eye discomfort according to dry eyes, eye strain, and 3 did not report experiencing any eye discomfort. Our hypothesis was actually that the fewer eye blinks that they had, the greater discomfort that they would experience. That wasn't held up. But it was important. I feel that the majority of them reported that they had eye strain and eye discomfort, no matter how many blinks that they had. So there was a great deal of strain in trying to focus on that. So just quickly through some of the physical discomfort scales. No one had pain, prior to the study in the neck area, but 10 of the 13 had discomfort ranging from 1.5 to 40, which is very significant, after the end of the study. So the participating for the time that they were in the study caused significant neck discomfort. Basically, for the shoulder and scapula, there was some discomfort reported, but it wasn't anything significant. It wasn't a significant number of individuals. The upper back, six did report discomfort, and that could be a part of the tension as well as part of the trying to control only moving the head. It didn't hit our half measure, so it still didn't meet our hypothesis. The arm, basically there was no arm discomfort. Even somebody who had discomfort before they began the study didn't have it afterwards, so we didn't feel that that impacted it at all. Lower back, there was no discomfort reported by nine of them. Total discomfort scores, and these are just some basic information about the scores, but then we compared them. So there were no trends or similarity in graphing it when we compared the total discomfort level, that's all of the Cornell added up together, compared to the total number of movements. So how many times they moved their head across the monitor as they control the mouse. There was no relationship in terms of that. There was also no relationship or trends or similarity of patterns when we compared the total discomfort scale to the time. And we did have some students who were down at about 17 or 18 minutes. The maximal head positions was the one that we, out of the video, stopped it and selected them and looked at the flexion and extension patterns. Only 8 of the 13 really had good enough landmarks to be able to compare it. So the maximal head positions is only on those 8 individuals. Basically, this is how we looked at it. We took a neutral position, and then we took their maximal non-neutral position, whether it was extension or flexion. And this is just some basic information on those positions and the degrees that they were in. Some were minimal, and some went up to 20 degrees. When we compared total discomfort to non-neutral cervical positions, there was no particular relationship. But when we looked at the sustained time, the amount of time that they were in those non-neutral positions, there's the beginning of some similar elliptical patterns that would show, and again, there was only 8 that we were able to get this data on, but it shows that if we had more people, if we engaged them, you know, in a little bit more involved study, that this may turn out to be something that was important and could be, well, you always keep your fingers crossed, significant, if you had a larger population, if you had better study techniques. And those are just some of the references. Did I stick under time? Am I good? Okay. So, any questions? Sorry. Yes?
Just briefly, just a single visit protocol.
In order to do the study, it was all one sitting. I thought 30 minutes was pretty minimal. I mean, people sit down at a computer and they spend a lot of time at a computer. So it's a one time they sat through the whole thing. And they actually had just a little bit of training ahead of time so that they actually were sitting there longer than 30 minutes. But the study time with the cameras on was 30 minutes to do those activities. Yes. How many times the device went out of calibration?
So, one alternative hypothesis is it might be some of the performance characteristics of the technology itself, which contributes to discomfort and pain. So, if it's causing somebody to engage in a certain kind of head and postural stances, heavy movements, things like that, before
In part, perhaps it could have. These were my students, and so they'd already gone through the computer access lab. So they'd already tried it and learned about different computer access. And then they had a minimal amount of time to just go through bringing up the different programs. So they were somewhat familiar with not to go off the monitor. And that was, we actually did do the study, or started to do the study with okay, I'm blanking out. Head mouse? Yeah, the head mouse. And that one went way out of calibration too many times, and I felt that it really disrupted the whole study, and we just dropped that one because you can't even go off the monitor a little bit, and you know, you've totally lost it. You have to stop everything, get it back on. And so that was one of the reasons we just did the tracker one in the study. That's why the Word document was 5 minutes out of the 30, yeah. And that was from experience prior to the study, working with students in the lab. Oh, they hate that. Yes. Oh, absolutely. I think in the paint program you had to have a much larger range of motion in order, because they were supposed to fill the page and they were supposed to do a house, a tree, and a person. So it absolutely, that took a lot more movement. So maybe graphic artists wouldn't have as much problem as people who are doing reports. That's a good question. I mean, it's another study to look at, absolutely. I think you're right. And, you know, to say, well, if you have to work on this program that's graphic, do that for so long and then switch over and do a report and, you know, do 3 pages of a report and then switch back. That absolutely one way of alternating around. Anything else? Okay, I think, do you need to close us out as moderator?